Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What's happened to push the Earth's population to unprecedented highs? And what will happen over the next several decades to stabilize the number of human beings coexisting on the planet? Demographers are confident that sometime during this year, there will be 7 billion people alive around the world. But that milestone will have different effects in different geographic regions, especially given that parts of the industrialized world have population increases that have more to do with declining death rates than climbing birth rates. Robert Kunzing is senior editor for the environment for National Geographic magazine and the author of the January cover story, Population 7 Billion, How Your World Will Change. The article is the first installment in a year-long series on population. Rob, welcome to Think.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be with you.
I have to start with something that's not specifically mentioned in the article, but do you know how demographers are able to say there are this many people? How accurate to the number are those estimates?
Not accurate to the number, but they're based on censuses that are done around the world in a lot of countries, not in all countries. And then they're, to a lesser extent, they're also based on surveys, less formal surveys that are done by various international agencies. And all this information from individual countries is pulled together by the United Nations Population Division. And they add it all up to make what's considered the most authoritative global estimate of how many people there are and projection of the future.
You start the piece with an account of Antony van Leeuwenhoek, who, in addition to his legendary work with microscopes, appears to have been one of the first people to try to estimate the world's population. And thank God his guess was way off the mark.
Yes, he did it he for completely, sort of reasons that are not relevant to our discussion today. He was actually just trying to show how he was the first microscopist, so he had this new window on a microscopic world, and he was trying to show just how amazing codfish are in terms of the number of reproductive cells they can produce when they spawn. And so he wanted to show that it's more than the number of people that could possibly be on Earth. So he did sort of a quick back of the envelope calculation at a time when there were almost no censuses, and extrapolated from Holland, where he lived, and he came up with a number of 13 billion. But it was it's actually not too far off of numbers that people now estimate might be able to survive, but it was really sort of fortuitous.
Mm-hmm. So how did we get from, it turns out there were about 500 million people living when he did in the 17th century, to 2 billion in the early 20th century?
Well, the main thing we did was find a way to delay death, mm-hmm. as you mentioned in your introduction. It's not that people started having more babies. It's just that fewer of those babies died once we developed modern sanitation techniques, vaccines, antibiotics in the 20th century. And so the population... And this happened all over the world, but at different times. A lot of those modern developments that happened first in Europe and then the United States, and so the population boom began there as well, and also in places like Japan. And it happened in the developed world over a period of a century or two. But then in the developing countries, it happened much more rapidly, and especially after World War II, because they received a big input of modern medicine and sanitation techniques from the West. And so death rates fell very rapidly in places like India and China after World War II, and as a consequence, the population exploded very rapidly.
And so it stands to reason that if you can be confident that a certain number of children will live, you don't necessarily have to have additional children as sort of insurance against that. But I guess it takes a generation or two for that to sink in.
That's exactly right. It can't. It almost can't possibly happen simultaneously. There are exceptions, but in general, the death rate is easier to reduce rapidly, but as you say, for that to sink into people's mentalities and affect their childbearing habits, inevitably takes a long time. And so I think that's a really important message to get across, that the reason the population explosion happened was not some sort of moral failing on our part that we just reproduced too much. It's we did something very good. We stopped innocent people from dying from disease, and the population explosion is an unintended side effect of that. So we, most of us probably, if we could do it over again, wouldn't do anything different.
Yeah.
And that once you realize that, I think it can affect your attitude towards the whole situation we face.
It's also interesting to think about the impact that the development of agriculture and then the improvement of agriculture has had on global population. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, agriculture, we wouldn't be able, the people that are kept from dying from childhood diseases wouldn't be able to survive much longer if there weren't food for them to eat. And there have been a number of developments in agriculture that have come along to forestall the famines that people have predicted. I mean, the fear that there would be so many people that it just wouldn't be possible for the planet to feed them is very old. It goes back to the 17th century, as I talk in my article, and the most famous person is Thomas Malthus, a British cleric and economist who predicted big famines right at the end of the 18th century. Well, about a decade later, chemical fertilizers were invented. The smallpox vaccine was coming out right as Malthus was writing. And a similar thing happened in the 1960s when we had a big wave of anxiety about the population explosion. The Green Revolution helped delay it. That does not mean, I hasten to add, I'm not trying to say population isn't a problem or that we don't face a serious challenge in finding a way to feed what could be 9 billion people by 2050. We do, but so far it's worked out.
Why is 2050 or thereabouts expected to be the year when population growth finally levels off?
A little bit later, I think, is what the UN's projection is, sometime maybe in the decade after 2050. Well, what's happening now is that the fertility rates are dropping almost all over the world, and they're dropping very fast. In countries like in Europe and in places in Japan and even in the U.S., they've already dropped quite far, and in some places population is actually decreasing. Other parts of the world are still catching up, but it's happening very fast. And so what demographers can do is look at the experiences of the countries that have already been through this transition from high death rates and high birth rates to low death rates and low birth rates, and project how it's going to proceed in the countries that are still going through it. And so they arrive at this, they sort of project these curves forward into the future and arrive at a time when it looks like the fertility will have sort of plateaued.
So among the countries where people are living longer and also having fewer children are Italy and Japan. In some ways, this is beneficial for the society, but it's having a huge impact on things like pension funds.
Yeah, and that's we have a debate going on about Social Security in this country that is directly related to the same phenomenon. All the developed countries face the same problem to one degree or another. The Greek economic crisis was directly related to their inability to fund their pension system, and it's going to be a big challenge in the next few decades. I tend to think it's going to be less of a challenge for rich countries to figure out retirement, big as it is, than it is for the planet as a whole to figure out how to keep environmental problems in check. But both are significant.
Yeah, let's talk about the environment, because there's this question of how many people can the planet support, and maybe we ought to say, well, how many Chinese or how many Americans, depending on sort of the kinds of resources that we consume, how many can the planet support?
Well, I'm not sure it makes sense anymore to distinguish, to separate the countries, because the fact is that the global agricultural system these days, it really is global. Grain prices, like oil prices, are set by a global market, and countries import and export onto this market. So the Chinese, for instance, they're self-supporting in their basic food grains, but as they, the big trend that's happening there is that as they get wealthier, they are eating more meat, mm-hmm. and they need feed to feed their livestock, and a lot of it is soybeans that they're now importing from Brazil, and that is related to deforestation of the Amazonian rainforest in Brazil, or it has been one of the drivers. And so things are connected in surprising ways, and that's one of the things that makes it such a global challenge.
Talk for a minute about the United States, because we have had rapidly declining death rates, which is a good thing. Still, though, we have relatively high birth rates compared to a lot of the rest of the developed world.
Yes, we certainly do. We're the champions, along with France and Ireland. We're practically the only developed countries that are having enough babies to reproduce the population. And in our case, there's a big difference to other countries in that we have a large immigration rate also. And that is contributing to the fact that the U.S. population is still growing. I mean, the census figures show we're over 300 million now, and then it's projected to keep growing to more than 400 million by 2050. The United States is kind of an exception in the among rich countries.
And the replacement rate, just to put it out there, it's 2.1 births per woman.
Yeah, that's because some children inevitably will die before they get old enough to have kids. Basically, a couple has to have two kids to reproduce the mother and father, and that's the level to keep the population stable. But that's assuming that those two kids then grow up to have kids themselves, and there will always be some childhood death. So in a developed country like the U.S., the rate is about 2.1. In other countries where more children die, the replacement fertility, as it's called, would be even higher, 2.3 or 4, depending on just how good their health system is, basically.
How much access do women throughout the world have to birth control these days?
It's very variable, and I think there have been estimates in some places they don't have very much. And, you know, I'm thinking now of Africa south of the Sahara, where population really still is exploding. And there's been one estimate that some 200 or 220 million women worldwide who want family planning abilities do not have access to the birth control.
And we should say that infant mortality is very high in sub-Saharan Africa.
It certainly is, yes. They basically have not been through this demographic transition that I mentioned before. Their mortality is still high and their fertility is still high.
Robert Kunzig is my guest. He's senior editor for the environment for National Geographic magazine and author of the January cover story, Population 7 Billion, How Your World Will Change. This is the first installment in a year-long series for National Geographic. If you'd like to join our conversation now, we'd love to hear from you at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Senior Editor for the Environment for National Geographic Magazine, Robert Kunzig. His January cover story is called Population 7 Billion, How Your World Will Change. You can join our conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. Rob, how influential in the 21st century are religious traditions that proscribe birth control of any kind?
I think there. It depends on the country. In India, which I spent some time in for this article, in the north of India, which still has quite a high fertility rate, part of that is attributed to the relatively high rate among Muslims, I think, but in other parts of the world, that's true. It's certainly true in our country as well. I mean, Mormon populations are known for a relatively high birth rate. The Hutterites are another. In general, I would say that you don't have fewer kids until you believe that the choice is yours. Hmm. If you believe that the choice is that it's in God's hands, that outlook is associated with a higher birth rate, no matter what the religion. And it's the switchover from those two views, I think, is pretty fundamental to bringing the population explosion to an end all over the world.
The content in the article about India is really fascinating because there is such a vast gap when you go from one geographic region to another, and one of the key factors you found in reducing birth rates has to do with the amount of education that women are able to get.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's something that I don't think people appreciate. In India, is their overall fertility rate is now 2.6, which is above replacement, but not that high. It's really fallen by half in just a few decades, and there's a kind of dividing line, a north-south dividing line in India, and the southern half of the country is already below replacement. There, women there are having fewer children than American women on the whole. But in the northern, the northern half is poorer largely, and they're still at a high rate. And when I went to a southwestern state called Kerala that has been known for some time that is not a rich state, but is made large investments in health and education, and they've been below replacement fertility for some time there, and it's become kind of a famous case among demographers. But I should say that doesn't mean that everything's rosy in Kerala. In fact, their economy is not too terrific, and so they are facing problems right now where they are basically dealing with problems like in the developed world, an aging population, but they're having to face it with less resources than we do. It's a fascinating place.
One thing that's interesting about the education factor for women, it makes sense that a woman who can read can understand birth control and can understand the way her body works. But it also has to do with the fact that a girl who is in school through a certain age is probably not marrying young and having kids.
That's right, and that's one of the, in India, people who are trying to reduce the fertility rate, that's one of the first things they want to do is just try to raise the age of marriage. There's a legal limit of 18, but it's not followed, especially in northern India. Girls still marry very young. And the whole culture, again, in northern India rewards girls for bearing children, and especially sons. When girls are educated, they tend to start seeing other possibilities for themselves. And so, you know, quite apart from the mechanics of how they'll manage not to have as many babies, what they want changes. And that's sort of a prerequisite. And they start to think, well, you know, motherhood is important, but there are also other things. They might like to work outside the home, for instance. And so that's the girls' literacy rate is often pretty strongly correlated with the fertility rate.
There's got to also be a change among educated women in terms of seeing the value in having a daughter or two as opposed to having babies until you get that son that you want.
Yes.
Not that there's anything wrong with a boy, but you understand what I'm saying.
But it's, and the attitudes. I mean, I'll tell you a little story. When I, in India, I visited, I'll talk about two places I visited. I went out into the countryside to a very poor village, and I sat there in a mangrove grove with the keeper of the mangoes, you know, a guy who was clearly just scraping by. He was. We met his daughter, who was must have been 12 or 13. We met her first. I was with some demographers who were doing a survey, and she was completely illiterate. She had not been to school. And then we talked to the father, and he basically said he had three daughters and three sons. The three sons, he had tried to get them to go to school, but they dropped out. The three daughters, well, it never even occurred to him that he would send them to school. But then in a neighborhood in Delhi, a squatter neighborhood, where people were, but a real city neighborhood where people were building a three- and four-story apartment buildings with their own hands. We met a young government worker himself from a rural background, not a lot of education. He had only two daughters, and he said, well, of course I'm sending them to school. So it's, and their ambition was to become engineers, which was, it's that kind of, a lot of this depends on a mental transition, on a cultural transition, which is encouraged by education. It's also encouraged by media, by TV shows and movies that portray women in a different light.
Robert Kunzig is my guest. We're talking about his National Geographic article, Population 7 Billion. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We'll go to the phones now and speak with Abhi in Dallas. Hi, Abhi.
Hi. I just had a question. I remember reading it in a magazine or some 2 years back. I read that Earth can hold about 12 billion people with the resources that we have right now. And if it explodes beyond that, we'll have some serious troubles. I just wanted to know if that is a myth or a fact.
What do you know about that 12 billion number, Bob, Rob?
Well, we have 7 billion now. We're expected to have 9 billion by 2050. There's no denying that if there were 12 billion people on Earth, things would be a lot harder than they are now. But I don't think anyone knows how many people the Earth can hold. And the reason is it doesn't depend just on the Earth. It depends on us. It depends on choices we make about how to use the Earth's resources. It depends on technologies we invent or have yet to invent it. So I set out in writing this article to try to find an answer to that question, and in fact, I spent a lot of time talking to a demographer who had written a book called How Many People Can the Earth Support? And the answer I got was, we just don't know. We can't predict it.
You have an interesting fact in the piece that will interest, I think, folks around here, that the entire global population could fit into a land area the size of Texas if Texas were settled like New York City.
Yes, and I should say that we in National Geographic did not actually recommend that everybody move to Texas.
We'd like some of you, but not all of you.
Sometimes seems like that's what's happening, maybe. you have, I guess, you had the biggest jump in population in the 2010 census, didn't you, or at least the biggest in absolute numbers. Yes, but that's right. But the numbers do actually work out. I checked those numbers myself. They work out almost precisely. If you give everybody on Earth the amount of sort of square footage that a New York City dweller has, they would take up about the land area of Texas. Now, on the other hand, if you just want to allow them to dance, they would only take up the area of Rhode Island, although some of them would have to be dancing in Narragansett Bay.
It is amazing how much space we take up with the things we need and produce and have to have.
Yeah, it's not really living space. I mean, the point of that is, that little analogy is just to show that it's not just sort of that there is a lot of room on the planet, but of course we need a lot more room to feed ourselves, and we use close to 40% of the surface area of the planet for farming and for ranching, basically, and that's going to be the big challenge, I think. In the next few decades, is preserving enough of the best farmland to feed a growing population.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Shannon in Arlington. Hi, Shannon.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
state of Texas recently received some nuclear waste, and Aztecans were not very happy about it. My question is, are there any plans, are there any prediction when we get to 7 billion or 8 billion or 12 billion, what are we going to do with our garbage globally, and what are we going to do with all the nuclear waste? Is it going to be mandatory that everybody has to have a share of it, or what's going to happen?
Wow.
I know you didn't look, we should say you didn't look at garbage and waste for this piece specifically.
No, but it's a good question. I'm not familiar with the details of the nuclear waste shipment that the caller is talking about. I will say that in general, we have a big problem with figuring out how to get enough energy. And so nuclear power is a is one solution that some people have been pushing. The nuclear industry is not growing very fast in the United States. It's been stalled, in fact, for a few decades. So I don't think we're going to be drowning in nuclear waste in 2050. And nuclear waste in particular doesn't take up a whole lot of room. I'm not an expert on this matter, I should say, but I think that's not going to be one of the biggest problems we face in 2050. Finding a way to get energy without causing global warming, I would say, is a bigger problem, which is also a waste problem, because basically, when we burn fossil fuels, we're putting a form of waste into the air, and so the waste problem is something we have to solve. But I don't think it's going to be a space problem per se.
I want to go back for a minute to India, because I was interested that sterilization remains the most common form of birth control there.
Yes. Overwhelmingly the most common. It's actually quite common in the United States as well. It may even be the leading fertility, birth control method in the United States. But in India, it's overwhelming. It's about 95%. And it's mostly or almost exclusively female women who get sterilized for cultural reasons, largely. And the government has lately been trying to change that by encouraging vasectomies. I actually visited a vasectomy clinic in Delhi, where I saw a couple men who were there and who were going to be getting $25 as a reward for undergoing their vasectomy.
And for people who aren't familiar, it's a much less expensive, less invasive, less risky procedure for men to undergo than for women.
Yes, all those things are true. And so, why is it that women get many more of the sterilizations? Well, that's another one of those cultural questions, I guess.
Did you sense that in most parts of the world, birth control is considered still a women's issue?
I would say yes, that's probably true.
And India had sort of a draconian set of policies a couple of decades ago that were so ultimately so bad and detrimental that they've sort of backed off from official.
They did. It was a brief period under Indira Gandhi, the prime minister at the time. This was in the mid 70s, around 1975, and her son Sanjay sort of spearheaded a campaign that in some ways was probably well intentioned. It involved planting trees, clearing slums, but also this was a time of global panic about population, and I believe that panic helped encourage the idea that they needed to use coerce people into having sterilizations. In some cases, they actually rounded people up and took them to vasectomy clinics.
What do we know about the long-term impacts of the one-child policy in China?
I'm glad you brought that up. That's a really interesting case. So China, they had the one-child policy was invented essentially by a rocket scientist who was looking for a non-military application of his science, and he encountered the idea that growth that there were limits to the planet's resources and figured that there were limits. He encountered it in the West on a trip to the West and went back home and made a calculation of how many people he thought China could support and devised what he thought was sort of the optimum missile trajectory, the optimum trajectory for the population to get there, and decided the best thing to do was to have sort of a radical measure. And he persuaded the government, and they adopted this one-child policy in 1980. And the population, the fertility rate was already dropping very fast in China, but it that maybe accelerated and certainly perpetuated it. And so you asked about the effects. Well, it's a good thing in that the Chinese population has not grown nearly as fast as it otherwise would. It's getting close to stability, but they are going to face the same problem we're facing here in the West of an aging population and lots of old people to support, and it's going to come on them really fast, much faster than it has come to us, and in about 15 or 20 years. And they don't have the same type of retirement system. They don't have our Social Security yet. So I think to me that's a good example of what can happen when you try to steer population like a rocket. When you focus on the overall number of people, I think there's going to be some serious unintended consequences in China.
So you've got that upside-down pyramid known as the 1-2-4 problem, where you have four grandparents, two parents, one working adult trying to support them all.
That's right. And it's going to, as I said, that situation is going to come on the Chinese, faster than it has come on the Europeans or the Americans.
How are Chinese people starting to be less satisfied with the one-child policy? It's always been controversial in some ways, but people have pretty much followed the laws.
Yes, I think they definitely are. I was actually at a demographers meeting in Dallas last year, where there was a session that involved Chinese demographers who are trying to lobby their government to end the one-child policy. And their main argument is it's not necessary anymore. Women are already having only one kid. You don't need to coerce them anymore.
Robert Kunzig is my guest. He's senior editor for the Environment for National Geographic magazine and author of the January cover story, Population 7 Billion, How Your World Will Change. We'll take more of your calls at 1-800-933-5372 right after the break. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/CFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Robert Kunzig. He is senior editor for the Environment for National Geographic magazine. The January cover story he wrote is called Population 7 Billion, How Your World Will Change. This is the first installment of a year-long series on population in National Geographic. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. Back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Bronnie in Fort Worth. Hi, Ronnie.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I'm retired from the Navy, and I spent a lot of time in the Philippines. And when I was over there, I knew people I knew locals who would have children, and more or less as investment for when they get old. They don't have Social Security and social programs to take care of old folks like we do here. So they would, literally have children. In some cases, anyway. And like I say, as an investment, I was just wondering, have you done any studies on that along those lines? Thank you very much. Have a good day.
Thanks for your call.
I think that's that Ronnie's right. That is a traditional function of children is to take care of people in their old age, and it's especially in rural societies, societies where most people still live on farms, the children also are used as workers. And what happens as societies get richer and as they urbanize is that the sort of economic calculus changes. The kids can now do better by growing up and getting an education and getting a job. And then in time, the societies also develop a retirement system. But yes, in a lot of the world today, kids, that is one motive for having kids.
We had Ted Fishman on a couple of weeks ago talking about Shock of Gray, which is his new book, which looks at the sort of aging of the entire planet.
Yeah.
And his observation was really interesting that a lot of these cultures that we in the West view as traditionally delighted to support their aging relatives are, in fact, not so delighted. They feel greatly burdened by it.
Yes, but I guess what's the alternative,
sure.
I guess?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that the aging, the problem of global aging, which is the flip side of the population boom, will come to us all. And I don't know if you talked with Ted Fishman about it, but one of the interesting aspects of it, there's a huge economic problem with it, but then there's also the sort of cultural psychological issue. What's it going to be like in societies where there's only one, where families typically only have one kid? What's it going to be like for kids like that to grow up without cousins and aunts and uncles, without brothers and sisters? That's going to change people's mentalities in ways that I think we can't completely foresee right now.
Yeah, it really changes the structure of what we know as family.
That's right. The family is going to change, and that's we focus on economic issues, but I think that is going to loom larger as we. Get there. People's ideas of what are the crucial relations to people's psychology is going to have to evolve.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we will speak with Ron in Fort Worth. Hi, Ron.
Hi, this is Ron in Fort Worth.
Hi, go right ahead.
What I wanted to know is what I'm mainly concerned about is how water will figure into our equation. And I've heard it will lead to wars and as far as purification and just water sustaining all of us. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks for your call. That's especially an interesting question given that the climate is changing.
That's a really interesting question. And water is going to be a big issue in the decades to come. India is a good example, actually. The story since the 60s in India is overall positive. They've gone from being a country that was in danger of mass famine, where it was, in fact, predicted back then, to a country that actually exports grain sometimes. But one of the ways they've done it is by depleting groundwater, by pumping more and more in dry northern areas to sustain these farms. And so it's not a practice that can go on. And we have, of course, in the United States, we have in the Southwest, especially the whole Colorado River Basin is facing a looming water crisis that is probably going to be aggravated by global warming. So I think the bottom line there is there is enough water on the planet to sustain even a population of 9 billion, but there are going to have to be some major changes in how we use it, and especially in agriculture, because most water, probably about 70% worldwide, is used in farming, and a lot of that is used very wastefully.
Let's talk about this question of famine, because one of the things that Malthus was concerned about and Ehrlich was concerned about was the fact that people would start to starve to death. Is the hunger, we hear often that 1 to 2 billion people on this planet go to bed hungry every night. Is the hunger we see on the planet now, is it an agricultural problem? Is it an environmental problem? Or is it a political and economic problem?
It's a political and economic, it's a distribution problem. Mm-hmm. It's not that the planet cannot produce enough of food or does not have enough food. It's that there are too many poor people who can't afford to buy it. And because the grain markets are global, the fate of people in some poor country can be, and their access to food can be decided by things that happen on the other side of the planet. Not even a failed harvest. Russia has a terrible summer like last summer. Their grain production goes down, and that little shock to the system has an effect on grain prices that then put food out of reach for poor people in Asia. So it's an economic problem. Now, that said, as population grows, then the problem of actually producing enough food is going to be a challenge. And I don't think we know exactly. We can't say right now how we're going to do it. There are technological developments and that will need to happen that have not happened yet, and that's what causes a lot of people to be worried about that.
So, Rob, as representatives gather at the UN and in cooperation with other international organizations looking at the issue of population and how it's changing, how well do we understand each other, at least in the developed world as opposed to the developing world? Is the developing world simply, does it feel like it's being told by the developed world what to do? Can you talk about that?
I think that it was that way a couple decades ago. There was a significant UN conference in Cairo in 1994. There was a watershed in this area where what had happened before had been sort of aggressive pushing of family planning by the West onto developing countries, driven by anxiety about the global population explosion. In 1994, at that conference, the tone shifted, and the efforts of there was a kind of consensus developed that family planning should be focused more on women and on individuals and on sort of improving the health of women, with family planning part of it. And I think that basic ideology remains today. But one of the things that motivated me in writing the article the way I did is I think that as we become more focused on global environmental problems, there's a danger of that same anxiety about the global numbers, of it returning, and of it maybe leading to the kind of practices, abuses that happened before.
So it sounds like your sense is that this is something we ought to be able to get a handle on and deal with appropriately.
Yes. I think it's a very fine line that you have to navigate on this issue between being a Pollyanna on the one side or a Cassandra on the other. I'm trying to go down the middle. The increasing numbers of people on Earth make things harder in a number of ways. But that does not mean that worrying about the number, about the global number, and trying hard to reduce it is the best strategy. I think we're going to be able to deal with 9 billion people if we can just focus on all the problems that we have to solve anyway, finding clean energy sources that are going to replace oil when the oil runs out, as it will have to one day, feeding the planet without depleting topsoil. All those problems have to be solved anyway, whether you're at 7 billion or 9 billion. And if we focus on those, I think we can get the job done.
Why do you think it's so hard for us to take that sort of, pardon the expression, global perspective on all the things, all the challenges we have, and understand that they're all interrelated? It seems that many people sort of pick one issue and stick with it, and maybe to the exclusion of fully understanding what else is in concert with that.
Because it's complicated. Gosh, just doing this one article made my brain hurt. I mean, it's not, it's we're local people, and this system has gotten too complicated for most of us to comprehend fully. But and I think we also tend to react emotionally, and we tend to look. I mean, I think it's a natural human instinct to want to blame someone else. And so, I don't know. Maybe I haven't been very articulate there. I don't have the answer to your question, I guess. But I think it's just these are big, hard problems, and I think thinking calmly about them is our best hope.
I was interested to read that the last time the global population has significantly dropped was during the Black Plague.
Yeah, that's not a strategy we probably want to adopt.
No.
Although you will hear some people speak darkly in those tones, like if only we had we're not allowing nature to take its course. Well, I don't think that's the way to approach it. Yes, population has been pretty much steadily growing since then, but it really took off in the 19th and especially in the 20th century with the development of sanitation and modern medicine.
Is there a lot of hand-wringing among demographers about the potential for some kind of pandemic infection?
I don't think there's a lot of hand-wringing among demographers. I think that's a that's an ever-present risk. I did not talk to anyone who seriously thought that was going to, that there would be such a pandemic that it would have a big impact on the global population. I mean, look at AIDS. AIDS has been a terrible pandemic. And even in Africa, where it has been by far, which has been hit the worst, it has not had a, it has not seriously inflected the numbers. Where Africa is where we're most worried about the population explosion.
Can you talk a little bit about the rest of the series plan for this year? Are you writing every piece, or are there...
Oh, no, 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 not at all. I'm not even... this is a big effort. God forbid. And I'm not even editing every piece. Mm-hmm. But we have a... So in we have articles coming up on some environmental problems, like ocean acidification. We have we'll have an article that looks at Brazil, which is a very you were interested in the effect of female education. Well, Brazil is a great case study for that. We'll have an article on Bangladesh. We will have an article on food and the need to preserve heirlooms. And then finally, we're going to end up the series with an article on cities, because that's one thing. That's the second huge historic transition that we're going through right now. We're going through an urban transition at the same time as we're going through a population transition. This, the people are flocking to cities all over the world, and by 2050, 70% of the planet is going to be living in cities. And so finding a way to manage them is going to be one of the key challenges.
So I guess as food production is handled more by corporate entities, people find their jobs in the city.
Yeah, as food production is mechanized more, as in part corporate entities, but as food production gets more efficient, there's less work on the land, and people and the cities are a draw anyway, because their life on the land in a lot of places like India is not easy. So the cities exert a strong attraction.
Yeah, it's really interesting, too, that some of the fastest-growing cities seem to be the ones without a great deal of urban planning resources.
That's right, and that tells you something about what life is like in the small towns and in the countryside around those cities.
Was there a particular, Rob, like a gee whiz fact that in all your research you like to talk about?
A gee whiz
You know, something
fact.
That you hadn't really thought about before that having done this, you can't forget.
To me, frankly, just learning, I'm a baby boomer. Mm-hmm. I grew up hearing about the population boom. I was surprised just to learn that it's coming to an end, that by the second half of this century, we're going to be looking at a plateau or maybe even a falling global population. And then I was surprised to hear also that China, which I've always thought of as, you know, the embodiment of population explosion, they have fewer babies there than we do in the United States. Their population is going to stabilize before ours, and that India is going to become the biggest. I guess those are a couple of the factoids that stuck with me.
Robert Kunzig is senior editor for the environment for National Geographic and author of Population 7 Billion. Rob, thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Well, thank you. It's been a real pleasure.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.